we're seeing this sort of technocratic medical system coming online saying we can solve the problem of aging. Aging is a disease and we can cure it. And that's fundamentally not true. And if we believe that, then we're going to go down these weird paths that get into very questionable moral decisions that we're making when it comes to life and what we want to do with it. And so the other important aspect to it, I think, is this regenerative medicine component, which is here. And it's going to come more and more. It's important to recognize that it's regenerative medicine provides really, really cool opportunities to help us live a little bit more pain-free, to recover some of our function.
If you haven't done so already, go ahead and click that subscribe button down below. It's a little red button. You punch that and it's going to notify you every time we put out a new episode that can help you improve your bone health. And then also, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com, sign up for the free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart. That's going to walk you through everything you need to be doing right now to get on the path to improvement and stronger bones. After you do those two things, go ahead and press play on this episode and I'll see you inside. Welcome to this episode of the Bone Coach Show. Joining us today to explore longevity, aging, and living a vibrant life in the future is Jason Prahl. Jason Prahl is a health educator, practitioner, author, and filmmaker. In 2018, his independent research and experience as a practitioner led him to create the Human Longevity Project, a 9-part film series that uncovers the true nature of chronic disease in our modern world. He's currently working on his next film series that explores ancient methods of healing mind, body, and soul from indigenous cultures around the world. And he's recently released his best-selling new book titled Beyond Longevity, A Proven Plan for Healing Faster, Feeling Better, and Thriving at Any Age. Jason, it is an absolute pleasure to have you. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kevin.
Awesome. Well, let's get into this. So I think this is a great topic. And before we jump into longevity and aging and how to live a vibrant life in the future, I would love to start with your story and your journey and even how you got to be where you are in this field today.
Yeah, it's kind of a roundabout journey. I mean, I started as a mechanical engineer. I was in that path for a number of years as a profession, doing very well, but I had health issues. And they actually started when I was probably 13. I had chronic joint pain at 13 years old. You know, I was an athlete. I played baseball, football, basketball, pretty much all year round, right? And so, I could logically conclude that it was due to all the activity that created that pain. And of course, that's what the doctors told me. But, there was something in the back of my mind that said, well, wait, there's guys 30 and 40 years old playing at the professional level and they've been doing so for 15, 20 years. You know, why am I suffering like this? And why do I have to rest my knee because of quote unquote overuse, right? Like that just didn't make sense to me. And so I couldn't find any answers in the traditional medical fields. And I didn't really have any exposure, didn't realize there was other ways to go about searching for answers either. And so dealt with chronic knee pain for 10, 12 years before I even started making headway in that regard. Then I had skin issues in college, something called seborrheic dermatitis. And I remember I played college football and I remember taking off my helmet and I was sweaty. And I remember scraping off like 3, 4, 5 layers of skin and just like chucking it to the ground. Like it was like wet newspaper on glass, right? Like it just came right off, exposing kind of fresh dermal layer that looked like I was a roast ham coming out of the oven type of thing, right? And so that prompted me to kind of find answers there. And I couldn't find answers. You know, I was given, the solution that I was given was to put like Selsun Blue and dandruff shampoo on my face and to take cold showers because the heat was causing inflammation. And so there's just like all this weird advice that I was being given, and that didn't work. And so this was at the beginning of kind of the internet really becoming a thing, 2000 or so. And I remember using like, web crawler and AOL search engines with like dial up, right? Like really horrible connection. And the internet wasn't like a resource. You're laughing because you know what I'm talking about, right? It wasn't a resource like it is today. I couldn't go listen to a podcast about like, skin conditions. I couldn't Google things and come up with this endless supply. But nevertheless, there was enough resource for me to start to uncover the fact that what I had learned about health, what I had learned about some of these chronic health issues was a little bit off, that there was people out there. And this was actually more in the days of forums and chat rooms and like people sharing wisdom in that way. And people were talking about the things that they were doing, right? And it was going to more organic foods. It was getting rid of the chemicals, not putting more on my face. And as I began to start to take some of these actions, I recognized a little bit of change. And so that opened me up, right? That was kind of just enough realization for me to sort of explore some of these other alternative methods. And that just, the floodgates opened after that, right? I started to recognize the deep truths that I was uncovering, right? At first, it was like, oh, maybe I'll try this and I'll try that because nothing else is working. And then I would find some success. But then I started to recognize what the truth was about all this stuff, about Big Pharma's role in things, about the medical system and how it really works and where its funding comes from and where research is coming from. And kind of the darkness of it, the light of it, right? And I began to put it in its proper place, right? And that is that the medical system has saved countless lives. Things like antibiotics and vaccinations have played a major role in stabilizing health across the Western world, right? And yet, putting those in their proper place is important. And so that's really what kind of, you know, prompted my journey. And then eventually I got to the point where I recognized that, hey, maybe I can do this as a profession. Maybe I can help other people resolve their chronic issues. And so I studied, you know, functional nutrition and eventually kind of functional medicine, functional neurology, started getting in more to the integrative practices and recognizing, oh, there's actually tests out there that we can run, functional lab tests, and you don't need to be a doctor, right? Like, this is wild. All you need to do is know how to navigate this world, order some tests if you want to use tests as your diagnostic tool. But then fundamentally, it's how you think about health. How do you think about the body? And fortunately for me, one of my sort of natural or developed gifts is to problem solve, right? Is sort of complex problem solving ability and looking at things in sort of a network fashion, right? So I was an engineer, like that's kind of what you do, right? It's this complex problem solving ability. And that's really what I like to do. I love puzzles. So ultimately for myself, as much as I was struggling and suffering in health issues, it was a big puzzle to solve. And same thing with others, you know, and I worked with clients for many, many years with cancers and autoimmune conditions and unknown syndromes. And that's really where I cut my teeth with respect to where the rubber really meets the road, right? Because solving your own health issues is one thing, helping others do the same is a totally different ball game. And it's different than reading research and thinking you know stuff about health, right? Because that can get you somewhere, but until you actually apply it to somebody that isn't you, then, you know, you're just not actually sure what's really true and what really makes people tick. So that's really where I think I learned the most, is working with countless people that have a number of different things going on.
And then you developed this 9-part film series also, which is this kind of led into your work called the Human Longevity Project. Can you talk about a little bit about that and what that looked like?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was interesting because the whole impetus for that was the fact that when I was working with people, what I realized was that there was a foundational level that I felt like I needed to teach every individual that came to me, right? So whether they had cancer, whether they had autoimmune conditions or digestive issues or skin issues or depression or anxiety or, you know, and you name it, there was fundamental things that we needed to make sure that they were doing or not doing throughout their day so that I could set the tone for the sort of emergence of health, right? And so that's really what it came about. And so because I kept teaching the same things over and over again, I wanted to find a medium where I could teach those same lessons in a way that wasn't just so boring. It wasn't just me just teaching, but I could actually explore the human condition. I could show that these things that I was realizing were important were universal truths, that they were being explored, or these were wisdoms and knowledge that had been around for thousands of years. And so we did the Human Longevity Project and we went to the blue zones. And so blue zones are these regions around the world where they've been identified statistically as places where people are reaching 100 at higher rates than other parts of the world, right? In a statistically significant way. And it's been verified and validated with birth certificates and everything. And so we really wanted to just not study the blue zone and what makes a blue zone a blue zone. Like that's interesting work. That's sort of demographic work and there's some interesting aspects. But I wanted to go find people that were in their 80s, 90s, 100s that were relatively healthy. That's what I wanted to tap into. And I thought, okay, well, that's, it's not like there's a database of healthy 95-year-olds, right? So it's like, I just want to go to where I can most readily find these people. And I love travel. So that was that. But what's cool about that is that we could actually find people from different cultures and see the truths that emerged, right? And so that's really what we did. And it was an unbelievable joy to be able to experience that. And there was a lot of challenges with it too, because it's, again, it's not like there's a database. So when you show up in Sardinia, you know, it's not like you go to the Blue Zone directory and there's like all these people that are over 100. You know, we had to like find these people in the middle of nowhere and see if we could, you know, interview them and have and translate and all that. So it was a very fun investigative journey that allowed me to explore the questions that I had, and also to test if the things that I thought that I knew were true in their culture, in their lives, and also to find out deeper truths and wisdoms that I just don't have the experience to share, right? Like, I mean, I always felt a little bit of a fraud trying to talk about longevity or aging, being that I'm only 42, right? Like, I actually don't know what it takes to get to 95, because I'm not there yet, right? So the best thing that I can do is ask these people and get a sense for really what contributed to their life. And the important part of that work is not necessarily to say, hey, what are you doing, you know, healthy 95-year-old, but what did your parents do? You know, what? How were you raised? What was it like, you know, in 1950, Ikaria, Greece? You know, what were the living conditions? And what you find out is that they lived a totally different life, a radically different life, to the point where we can't even recognize it in the way we live. And so in that work, what we found was that they had very unique challenges and very unique opportunities. And same thing with us in the West. We have unique challenges that they never had to deal with. And we have unique opportunities that they didn't have the luxury of, right? So we're kind of in two different worlds. And so while there's truth that we can bring forward from the past, and they are worth bringing forward, we can conserve, there are also new things that we are faced with that we must learn about, understand, and recognize how to navigate so that we don't get caught in a sort of disaster cycle when it comes to our health.
Are there common things that you've seen, you know, even across cultures too, in the people that are 70s, 80s, 90s, living healthy, active lives? Are there common things?
Yeah, what's wild too about that is that what you find is that those common things, and I'll get to what they are, they're changing. So they're being lost because of the development, and because of sort of the Western influence and just the natural development of things, they're actually being lost. And so they're losing some of the benefits that they provided. And some of those things are the fact that they lived in tight, close communities that had not just a community, but they had connection. The communities themselves were a vehicle for connection. They were a vehicle for safety, for security, right? Support. And so through those small village communities up in the mountains, they had to rely on one another. They were dependent on it. That was up to their survival. And so because of that, they developed a really strong sense that they're okay. People have their back. So there was a strong connection. There was a tight-knit aspect to the way that they lived their lives. They were interconnected with the people. They were interconnected with the land and the plants and the animals. They were interconnected with the seasons and the cycles of the day, right? They were interconnected with God. Like they were fundamentally connected with all things that are life-affirming, right? That's what's important. If we look at contrast it with our society, you know, the things that we're finding connection with are our social media channels and our technology, and which, you know, phone is just being released, and what show I watched that, you know, you got to watch because it's so good, you know, we're connecting over very interesting things, which isn't to say that it's bad, but we're missing some of the juice. We're missing some of the life-affirming qualities. And this is why there's such a big movement to get back out into nature, to do these kind of like, you know, detox, tech detox retreats, where we just leave our technology behind and we get back out into nature. And when, you know, what's a rare thing for me is to go out and find an open piece of land where I can look up at the sky and see stars. Like, the fact that that's rare is weird, right? The fact that it's so hard for most of us in the United States to look up at the sky and see not just one or two or 50 or 100, but millions and millions of stars, right? And there's been a few places that I've been to that you can do that. And it's like, it's awe-inspiring, right? It puts you in perspective puts life into perspective, right? So we're missing some of the perspective. We're missing some of the fundamental aspects of what really makes this life worth living. And it isn't the money, and it isn't the technology, and it isn't all the things that we're doing. It's more on the being side, right? And so they're in the being aspect of reality, probably a lot more than I think we are conditioned in the West. But again, this isn't, let's just say, our fault per se, right? We are a product of our environments, and this is the environment that we've all been born into and that we've participated in. And so it's our responsibility, no question. And it's very difficult to go against the culture, to go against your environment, and to sort of to separate, right? So now we're faced with this really interesting challenge of like, how do we navigate this? Because I'm sitting here talking on, you know, a video chat with you, right? Which is such a gift, right? It's the coolest thing ever. And we get to share this information, and hopefully this helps a lot of people. So we can be of service in such a beautiful way, as long as we're not abandoning the core things that really make us healthy and happy and connected, right? And so I think that was probably the biggest component, was that aspect of their environment and their family structure and their neighboring structure of their sort of small village lifestyle. And they knew it. It's not like it was just an accident. They knew that there were structures. In fact, in Okinawa, they have something called the Mowai. And this is a group that gets together from a young age, and they meet regularly, and like 10 people or maybe more. And they would meet regularly to support one another on a regular basis. So it's like a support group, both mentally, emotionally, and also financially. They would also contribute into a pot, and that provided like this insurance policy. So if somebody in the group really got into dire straits and they needed money, that the support group was there. And these became basically lifelong friends because of it, right? So that's something that can better be done in a smaller group. Whereas we start getting into big cities like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Seattle, where I'm from, that's challenging to sort of navigate that, right? And it doesn't really work with our structure of our society. We're very independent. We take a lot of pride in our independence, right? We move out of the home when we're 18 or 20 or whatever it is, and we make a life for ourselves. And, you know, independent woman, independent man, right? Like there's a lot of pride, and that's a great quality to have. And if we go down that path too far, then we're going to be alone. We're going to feel alone. We're not going to feel like we're supported and connected. And it turns out that those are the qualities that time and again, through scientific study after scientific study, have shown to lead to greater happiness, greater health outcomes, and longer life.
You know, maybe we can talk, and we'll come back to this in just a little bit, maybe about some diet, nutritional, exercise things like that. Maybe we can talk about some of the common things there as well. But you know, someone recently said to me, I want to live until I die and not die until I live. You know, and so often when I see people with osteoporosis, they're basically at a point of great concern for their future. And they're concerned about fracture or about being with their loved ones or all these things that were activities they love doing their entire lives. They're worried that that's, you know, going to be taken away from them. And I'm really seeing, after working with thousands of people now, you know, people don't just want to be here X number of years longer. There's usually something they want to accomplish or experience or somebody they want to be with. And they want those years to be good quality years. They want them to be pain-free and they want them to be active. And so when we're talking about longevity, which I hope you can help us understand a little bit better, what really is longevity? Is it just being here longer, or is part of that just having better quality years as you are here longer?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really good question, right? I mean, I don't know. Is that something you've ever thought about? Like, have you actually ever thought about how many years you'll be here? And if so, what is that? Like, what do you do with that information? You know, like it's tricky because it's like, you know, on one hand, I could say that I want to be here till I'm 100 or 120 maybe, right? Which is kind of we're budging up against that sort of maximal human lifespan that we think. And then there's ideas that we could maybe even extend life beyond that with some technological help and stem cell research. And, you know, we have these things called Yamanaka factors that these transcription factors that have led to longer lifespan in mice. But, you know, it's interesting because I interviewed a 94-year-old lady, and you know, most of her family had passed away, you know, her husband and some of her kids, you know, her sisters, her, of course, her parents, right? And a lot of her friends had passed away, right? So she didn't have like a huge friend group that was of her peers and her age group, and her family was dwindling. And so, you know, it's interesting because what crossed my mind is, well, what's the point, right? Like, you're 94 and like all the people that you've known throughout your life have passed away. Is it even really worth living at that point? Like, where's the juice in life at that point, right? And look, as far as I know, nobody I know is reversing their age. Not a single person, no matter how many people like to talk about it, nobody I know. And the reason I know that is because I've been watching them for the last 5 years and they look older now, like obviously older, right? So you can look at all these people talking about longevity and anti-aging and reversing, you know, aging backwards and all this stuff. It's nonsense. You cannot age backwards. You cannot reverse your age. You are moving in one direction. That is the way this process works. So why do we want, like, do I really want to be around at 110 if I don't have anybody that I'm really connected with, and some of my children have passed away, and, you know, I might have but I can't do much either, right? It's not like I can go climb a mountain in the same way that I did when I was younger. So all my function is limited. I sat with a 105-year-old man in Sardinia, and he was able to ride a bike, and I was like dumbfounded. It was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. 105-year-old man riding a bike on his own. He said he plays chess with his son. You know, like, that is inspiring to me. And but what does that show us? That means that his function has declined to such a degree that I think him riding a bike is the coolest thing, right? If you rode a bike, Kevin, I wouldn't think much of it, right? But give yourself another 70 years and I'm like, whoa, do you see Kevin? Like, holy smokes, he rode a bike, right? So that shows us our perspective on aging. And I think that's what you find when you meet and you talk to these people that are in those older years, is that there's a winding down, there's a letting go of this idea of holding on to life. And so to me, it's really not about that. You know, there's been a number of people actually that get into their 90s and 100s, and they get to the point where they can't see as well, they can't hardly hear, their function has declined to such a degree, they actually consider, and many have gone with the sort of assisted suicide route, right? In Switzerland and some of these other sort of countries that have that. And I think that's really interesting, right? So it's like, there is a process. And I think the more we can embrace this idea that we get older, we decline, that allows us to step into the moment today and recognize the beauty of my youth, the gratitude that I have for the function that I have, that I can see you, that I can hear you clearly, right? The fact that I can taste, the fact that I can feel the breeze. These are joys. This is the gift that the present provides to us. And the longer that we drag out this life, let's say we found ways to live to 250 years because of all this cool gene technology that we have and all blah, blah, blah. That just means to the average person that this year is just that much less important because it's just one of 250. But if this year is one of 10 remaining you have left, your perspective comes into clarity real quick. Oh, wow, the time is limited, right? So I would rather take that perspective that even if I could theoretically live to 250, I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. So there's a recognition, I think, that we all can have about the preciousness of life as a whole and the preciousness of this moment. So to me, when we talk about even quality of life, because there's paraplegics, quadriplegics, there's all kinds of people that are living a life in pure joy and well-being, and they're inspirational, and they're doing bigger things than I can even imagine. You know, and I look at them and I'm like, I don't understand, because I feel like that if I was in that position, I wouldn't be like that, right? So it tells me that I've got more inner work to do, because there's my happiness and well-being and joy is still conditional. It's still conditional on all these things, right? So to me, that's the work. The work is in my ability to be in this present moment. So it's like, how many present moments can you accumulate, so to speak, right? In the sadness, in the grief, in the pain, in the joy, in the all the beauty that life holds, right? This once we sit with this stuff long enough, we just start dipping back into the religious territory, the spiritual territory, because there's nowhere else to go with it, right? It's like, there's a preciousness here. It really has nothing to do with how many years you live on this planet. It's all too short, right? And if you ask anybody that's in their 80s, 90s, and 100, they tend to just say, well, I don't know. I go when I go, you know, and it's okay. So I think when we're young, we have this idea that we're going to hold on and we're going to, you know, I'm going to be the longest living person and I'm going to do whatever I can. And then I think as we age and things start to break down and we start to see this process unfold, I think as acceptance starts to land, we start to recognize the hubris kind of fades away a little bit. And we recognize that we're not the ones in charge here. And we let go of this idea that I need to control this life. And instead I can just enjoy it, right? And that to me becomes the big lesson. And the more that I can allow that to sort of really sink in, then the more I can wake up each day and be happy, even with my illness, even with my sickness, even with my knee pains or my chronic headaches or whatever the case is. It just starts to become this mirror for anything that I can recognize about my life that is good is an opportunity for me to recognize that that's all it's about, right? And it's all a gift. So again, I know we can get into sort of this airy-fairy territory really quick, but that's what you realize. And if you sit with people on their deathbed and you get, the closer you get to that moment, right? If you talk to hospice nurses and that kind of thing, and you sit and you ask questions to those who have helped people in their transition as they die, the things that are coming out of their mouth, it's like, it's wild. The stories you hear, the truths that they tell, the regrets that they have, like it all starts to come out, right? And so to me, it's like, that's the stuff that I want to process now. And part of that is recovering health, because the more we can step out of this sort of chronic disease, ill health position, the more we can pursue these deeper aspects. And in many ways, they're related. And as we resolve the chronic health issues, these deeper realizations, these deeper awakenings, the deeper truths start to become embodied more and more. And so they become one and the same.
I think it's really interesting how mortality engenders appreciation for the present moment. And it really, really does. I know even if, you know, it's not you that's in that situation, it's somebody else or somebody you love or somebody you know, or somebody that you don't even know that you just see on the news, you can't help but think of you and your situation. Also, you may think of them, but you're also thinking of yourself. And it does bring this sense of appreciation and gratitude for the present moment. And I also think, too, that death is a part of life, right? That's going to happen. And aging is going to eventually lead to death. But aging doesn't have to be this negative thing that I think a lot of times we put out there that I'm, you know, I remember my mom told me this all the time growing up. She still says it sometimes now. Sucks getting old, kid. And I think in my head, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. Like aging does not have to be a negative thing. So can you maybe even help us understand what is aging? Can you define it? Like, when does it begin? Where does it occur? Is it this system-wide thing, or is it like organ-specific or cell-specific, or is it programmed, or is it like this accumulation of damage? Can you help us understand what that is?
The answer is no, I can't. I can help talk through it, but this is where we're at in aging science. This is what's funny. I sort of jokingly say that because, you know, a lot of the most prominent longevity researchers out there are kind of getting confused with this. And it's this idea that that aging is the accumulation of damage, right? And really, when we look at aging and the theories of aging, there's two main groups. One group says it's programmed. In other words, there's something in our biology that is guiding the process of aging itself. And the other group says, no, it's the accumulation of damage that is then leading to sort of this system breakdown over time that accumulates that we're not recovering from, and that's what's leading to disease and ultimately death. And what's interesting about that is that in my world, they're both correct, but what's fundamentally driving the aging process is programmed. The overwhelming evidence is that. that doesn't mean the damage theories are incorrect, because there's some damage theories that look at the membrane and they say, okay, what's the damage accumulating at the membrane that's causing the breakdown of the everything else? And then some people may say it's the damage at the mitochondria level. And mitochondria are critical when we look at cancers, when we look at all metabolic conditions. They have to do with mitochondria. They're the fundamental source of energy production. They're heavily involved in cellular signaling. They make hormones. The mitochondria are fundamental, like no question. And then other people say, no, it's the damage to the telomeres, right? It's the damage to the gene themselves. But there's all kinds of different ways that the genes can get damaged beyond just telomeres, right? So people are looking at telomeres and they're measuring the telomere length and they're saying, okay, this is a good indicator of how old you are, biologically speaking. And the reality is that's not really true, because we can't measure everything altogether, right? I don't know really anybody that dies by all of their organs failing at the same time, right? Like everything doesn't just go boom, right? There's something that is, so in other words, like the damage, it tends to be organ specific, tissue specific, and it accumulates based on the uniqueness of that individual, both constitutionally and how their life is played out, right? And some would argue that there's karmic aspects, that come into play. So there's all kinds of ways that might come into play. But the question fundamentally about what is aging is, we can look at it like this, right? Like, why is it that a lion lives to about 20 years in the wild? Like, that's kind of the maximum lifespan of a lion. Why? I mean, what is it, just the every lion accumulates the same damage in this sort of same fashion? Like, it just happens to be that way, and there's no lion out there that lives to 35 or 40 in the wild? And yet we take a lion and we in captivity, they can actually live to about 30. So there's support, so that tends to be kind of their maximum life. And same thing with an elephant, same thing with a bird, seal, you name it, right? Like, every organism seems to have kind of this average lifespan. For humans, it's about 80 right now, and a kind of a maximum lifespan for humans, it seems to be about 120. And as we get into those later years, like, the drop off is significant, about from the number of people who make it to 105 to 106. It's like a severe drop off. So we're coming up against some kind of like imaginary barrier. Now, can we theoretically move beyond that? Maybe, but that's not the point. The point is, what is aging? What is driving that process of aging? And so, when we look at like the thymus gland is interesting, because it's actually heavily involved with aging itself. It's responsible for T cells, big part of the immune system, right? But it's in communication with the pineal gland, which is really interesting. The peak thymic function, in other words, the time where your thymus becomes the most, the best functioning, is about 13 years old. So we have this developmental process. Thymus gland peaks at about 13, and then it starts declining at about puberty. That's really interesting, because our brain hasn't even fully developed. Our nervous system is not even fully developed, right? So we go from a single cellular zygote into multicellular organisms. So we're actually developing complexity. So the question is, are we aging? I mean, maybe. Right? Damage is occurring, no question. Anytime cells are dividing, there's damage, right? But yet we're repairing. And so is the repairing happening to a greater degree than the damage is accumulating? Because we have repair mechanisms, right? So the question then becomes, why aren't we turning on these? When do we lose control of the system, right? If theoretically we are able to repair at the same or to a greater degree than the damage is accumulating, then at what point in our development do we lose control of that system, and why? Like, that becomes unclear, right? But what we see is these developmental periods in our life where growth happens, teeth come in, right? Like, what is guiding that process? That's not just random cells dividing haphazardly and, damage is randomly occurring. No, there's something driving the developmental process, and the programmed theories of aging point to this idea that they're coupled. In other words, the same things, the same hormones, the same processes, the same genetic expressions, right, the methylation patterns that we see that are involved with the development of the human are the exact same things that are leading to the aging itself, right? We see this in menopause. We see another spike in certain hormones, and methylation changes in big ways, right? So that's not happening because damage is accumulating. That's happening because there's something driving that process. Damage is accumulating, no question, and it can either accelerate, so to speak, what we think of as aging or the effects of aging, but that's really what it is. Aging is occurring and the effects of aging are seen. Gray hair, right? Sagging skin, we're not producing as much elastin and collagen, right? Our eye colors are changing. I mean, I look at my son's eyes and it's like the whites of his eyes are just like unbelievable, right? Like we have changes, right? I'm growing more hair in my ears, right? Like that's not because damage is occurring, right? There's something happening on a bigger level. So that's aging and we don't know what drives that. So I think it's important for us as researchers, as scientists, to recognize we have no clue what aging is. All we see are the effects of aging. So it's like we're seeing the movie screen and we think that's real life. And it's like, no, there's something actually projecting that. And this is the effect of that projection, right? And so that's what we're noticing. Now, if we're living out of alignment, if we're doing the wrong things, if we're not sleeping well, if we have a lot of fear in our system, these are the things that can create more damage over time. And it looks as though we're aging faster, so to speak. But all we're saying is that we're seeing more of the effects that we tend to see in the aging process over time. That's kind of the skinny on that, right? So I think it's important for me to recognize what is aging. We don't know. We don't know what drives it. We don't know why every single human seems to go through the exact same process, except for some sort of disease processes that are genetic, and they can provide clues into aging. Actually, is it a certain like Werner syndrome? There's certain like advanced aging that happens, and we can start to look at that. So there's clues that we can tap into, but we start to recognize that there's certain perhaps processes that are fundamental to development and aging, and then we have the damaged stuff too. And so that's where it becomes paramount to clean up the damage and to live in alignment and to construct our environment in a way that limits the damage, that turns on the repair processes as much as possible. That is not going to slow aging. That's just going to clean up the damage. That's going to mean that you're going to be healthier. That's going to mean that you're going to be more vibrant. That's going to mean that you're going to keep your eyesight and your hearing, and you're not going to have pain as much, and you'll be able to walk upright. These are the things. Like I saw a 90 something year old woman doing like unbelievable yoga, right? That is life and vitality in this woman, prana, chi, through the system. She's still aging, right? So it's important, I think, we keep these two things separate. And the reason it's important, because right now we're seeing this sort of technocratic medical system coming online saying we can solve the problem of aging. Aging is a disease and we can cure it. And that's fundamentally not true. And if we believe that, then we're going to go down these weird paths that get into very questionable moral decisions that we're making when it comes to life and what we want to do with it. And so the other important aspect to it, I think, is this regenerative medicine component, which is here. And it's going to come more and more. It's important to recognize that regenerative medicine provides really, really cool opportunities to help us live a little bit more pain-free, to recover some of our function. It's also not something that we can use to escape death. We can't prevent aging with some of this stuff, right? And so it becomes important to recognize that to live a life in harmony, in balance, in alignment, and then yes, use the regenerative therapies to help recover some function, to help get you out of pain. Like that's cool. That's great. We should do that. But it can't be the remedy for living a life of imbalance, out of alignment, right? Of disharmony within yourself and in the environment, right? So I think everything in its proper place is the right approach here.
What are the things that you've come to find are the best for slowing and stopping and preventing that damage from happening?
The most important part of health occurs between preconception and about 7 years old, 10 years old, somewhere in there. That sets the stage for how your nervous system functions, your behavioral patterns, your thought processes, your emotional patterns. That's where most of that gets laid down, right? And my son is three, and I had this really interesting realization the other day that he's pretty much never going to remember. He's not going to remember anything up to this point. Like, I've had a lot of great times. Like, and I'm like, he's not going to remember a thing, right? And I'm like, shit. So, you know, it's funny to recognize that, and that's another part of it, right? If we look at the child brain, they operate in a completely different brainwave state. They are completely open to the entire reality, and adults aren't like that, unless we are practiced meditators and we can get our brains to train in that way, right? So even that is really interesting to think about. Like, that's a developmental progression, right? And so that's a big part, right? Like, what happens there? Now, most people listening to this are probably older than 7. So the reason I point to that is because that's where we can look to for clues as to why we're behaving the way we are. What are the thought processes going on? What's the state of my nervous system at rest? Some people have a nervous system at rest that's pretty jacked up. They think they're at rest because for them, that's rest. It's relative rest for them. And other people at rest, their system's like just so at peace, right? And a lot of that is dictated by those early childhood experiences and that kind of thing. And so that's a really good place to look to for how to solve some of these challenges that we're running up against, because a lot of it is based in, I'll use the word trauma, but it's really core wounds, right? Things that we didn't get, the connection, the consistent love, the unconditional love. Not a single one of us got unconditional love, right? It was all conditional because we're human, right? And so these are some of the things that establish. Now, fortunately, we don't have to get it right as parents or caregivers all of the time. But if we don't get those needs met, and then it's gonna create thought patterns, emotional patterns, and behavioral patterns that aren't necessarily in alignment. And so the sleep, right? Getting really good restful sleep, that may not be possible for somebody until they go resolve some of these challenges that are in their system, unprocessed emotions and experiences from childhood. Sleep is really, really important. You know, eating a good diet. I mean, what a vague statement that is, right? Like, what does it even mean to have a good diet, right? What we realize is that means something different for everybody. Everybody's got a constitution that is unique, but there's universal principles that come down to food, right? How well we're digesting that food. That is, we can't argue this. So there are ways that we can improve digestion. So you figure out what's good for you to eat, but I can tell you for sure that if you're eating the proper diet and you can't digest it, it's going to be creating harm in the body. It's going to be creating inflammation in the body. And so digestion is a key thing to focus on. So many people skip over that process, right? What it means to chew your food thoroughly, to sit down in a relaxed state, to eat at the proper times when your body is actually capable of digesting some of these more challenging foods, right? Not overeating and overtaxing that digestive system, because even it has a capacity. You can't just eat to infinity and expect it to all digest well, right? To be hungry when you eat food, to exercise at the proper times of day when the body's receptive to that exercise, the appropriate exercise for you in your life, given your situation and your condition and how well recovered you are, right? Fortunately, we have things like heart rate variability, HRV. We can monitor these things now that sort of give the state of our nervous system and how well rested it is to accept a hard workout or a hard exercise regimen, right? So playing this game of figuring out what I need when I need it, such that I'm not overburdening my system, because there's a lot of people out there that they're over-exercising and they're taxing their system beyond what it's capable of for whatever reason. And it may be because they have certain chronic issues they're dealing with. It may be because their sort of stress bucket is overfilled because of chronic mold exposure, because of emotional traumas, because of any number of things, right? So it's really figuring out what you're capable of and what is the right thing for you. The general thing I'll say about diet and eating food and not eating food and exercising and not exercising is that we want to live at the end of the spectrums. That's really where the gold is. In other words, you want really good deep rest, and then you want to push yourself to the point where your system is challenged and it can recover, and then you want to rest again, right? So many of us are caught in this no man's land where we're kind of exercising sometimes, but not really pushing ourselves, but we're also not resting either. So our system's kind of always stressed and taxed. We're sleeping, but we're not sleeping in the right times. And so we're not getting restful sleep, right? We don't really go out in the cold anymore because that's uncomfortable. And it's too hot, so I'm going to turn on my air conditioning, right? So we're not getting challenged in that way. We don't go out in the sun and experience, you know, full on bright sunlight in our eyes, on our skin for the appropriate amount of time. And then equally go into, you know, pitch black darkness where there's only moon, stars, and fire, right? So we're missing the ends of the spectrum. And that's where the gold really is in that deep rest, that deep darkness, right? I mean, just imagine the yin yang sign, right? It's like we need the extremities that allow our system to become more anti-fragile, right? It allows us to become stronger as we face these hormetic stressors, these things that sort of push our system. But just as much as we need to push our system, we need that deep rest. We need to find that rest. So those are kind of the keys, I think, to building a robust system that is capable of reducing the damage, that is capable of recovering and capable of staying strong as we age, because the aging is going to occur. So how do we limit that? Right? And it's not by doing nothing, but it's also not by doing everything. You know, we've got to be at the ends of the spectrum, I think.
And all of those things affect, you know, genetic expression too. Yeah. And, you know, the sound, the light, the different energies, emotions, all those different things play into your genetic expression too. Could you talk about epigenetics for a minute and just how that affects this entire process?
Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting thing, right? It's becoming more of a talking point now in the health world, right? This idea that we are beyond our genes, right? That the genes don't control us. It's all the things in the environment that sort of express genes or suppress the expression. And it's important to recognize that we are open energetic systems, right? Our and that means that everything affects us, right? Our thoughts affect epigenetic expression, our emotions, our beliefs, right? And the question I think some people have is, well, how can a belief or a thought affect how my genes get expressed? And the most obvious example I can give you is if I told you that tomorrow you needed to give a speech in front of 1,000 people, right? Instantly, if I mention that to you, your physiology is probably going to change, right, to some degree. And if I had a bunch of testing equipment on there, it would render that, right? And then you get up there tomorrow, you prepare all night, right? You're stressed all night, you probably don't sleep very well. So that's affecting not only your epigenetic expression, but now your behavior and how you're living your life. And then you get up on stage the next day and you get up there, instantly you start sweating, your mind kind of goes blank, you're unable to think clearly, your pupils dilate, right? Blood pressure rises, heart's beating out of your chest, your armpits are just dripping now, right? And why? Because you have to give a speech? Because you have to talk to other humans? No, it's actually because there's something in the back of your mind that is registering that there's some that is unsafe, right? There's something, you're referencing something in the past, probably something in school or where you weren't accepted or you were laughed at, right? These conditioned beliefs and ideas and thoughts and realities where you weren't received well. And there's a potential that in this moment, you're going to get rejected from the crowd. You're going to get laughed at. You're going to get booed off stage. People are not going to like you. You're not going to be welcomed. And that is, so thoughts from the conditioned thoughts from the past based on experiences are now being carried into the future, into this moment right now, and your biology is responding. So your thoughts, beliefs, and emotions that are all conditioned, by the way, because that's not the truth, but your biology thinks it's the truth. Now your genes are responding that you're in danger, that that there's a big threat. So turn everything on. That means your sex hormones are going to decline because it's not a good time to have sex, right? When you're in dead fear, you're not going to digest food very well because why would you need to digest food if there's a bear or if you're in danger, right? So all of your genetic expression is changing based on that. So this is happening on micro levels throughout the day. When I get the email, when I see the dings, when I pop on my phone and I see all these notifications, right? When my wife tells me we need to talk, right? Like, oh crap, what did I do, right? So all these things start to happen. When my son aggravates me and kicks up something in me that frustrates me or whatever the case is, this is happening all the time. And so all of these things start to influence us. Now, with that awareness, with that understanding, that means that everything I do, say, think, feel, believe, and interact with influences me. So now, how empowering is that? That means that I can select the music that I'm listening to empower me. I can listen to empowering words from somebody who's inspiring me, right? I can listen to prayer, or I can listen to meditation. I can listen to these guided aspects that get me into states. I can stand with my hands on my hips and a big smile on my face and my feet open wide, and I'm gonna change my genetic expression. I'm gonna turn on hormones. This is wild. This is why we have the laughing yogis out there. All they do is laugh, and it creates people, it gets this laugh energy into the room, and it heals people. We can change these things based on really, really interesting aspects to our biology. This is how infrared light works. This is how UV light works. This is how all of our light therapies and sound therapies, they're influencing our biology because we are open energetic systems. And so everything you do, think, feel, say, eat is going to influence you. And so it's worth tuning into some of these things. And that's what epigenetic expression is. It's how your genes are responding to your environment. And the cool thing is that you're not just your genes. You're the genes of your microbes that are living within you and on you. You're the genes of your mitochondria, which come, you know, at least what science thinks, from only from the mother's lineage. So from mom to mom to mom to mom, all the way back to the original mother. That's where mitochondria come from. And the mitochondria and genes are really interesting, right? Because they're not static. In other words, sure, they're expressing, you know, like kind of like a light switch on and off, or you know, a dimmer switch probably is more accurate, but they're expressing or not expressing, but over time they actually change. So when we have offspring, sure, there's like a lottery and we pass some along and don't pass others along, but there's also epigenetic changes over through generations. And we know this through some of the mouse models that we've seen. You take a mouse and expose it to lavender, and then you shock the mouse, right? And so actually it wasn't lavender, it was a different scent, rose. Anyway, doesn't matter, it was a scent. We'll just call it lavender. But you expose it to a scent and you electrocute it, right? And so now the mouse over time, if you do it enough, you condition that mouse, then it's gonna, every time it smells lavender, it's going to, the nervous system's gonna spike, that danger is here. Now you take that mouse and you breed it with another mouse that's never been exposed to any electrocution. They have a pup. That pup has also never been exposed to any electrocution, but smells lavender. Nervous system spikes. So now that epigenetic change that has been conditioned in the mouse has now been passed down one generation because only one parent experienced this threat. Now you have the first generation. You take that mouse who, again, has never been electrocuted, has only smelled lavender and experiences a nervous system spike, gets paired with another mouse who has never been exposed. They have a pup. Now you have a second generation. That pup, same thing. Now every time they smell lavender, nervous system spikes. So by that time, imagine these are humans, that second generation's going, what's going on with my nervous system? Why can't I relax? You know, and meanwhile, they're living in lavender fields. Right? Like that is brilliant epigenetic expression that's now been transferred down through the generations because it's a warning signal. Hey, this is what's happened in the past. Watch out. Right? So that's a brilliant mechanism, but that is an epigenetic change. So what we see is that some of these genetic changes will start to happen over time, over many, many generations. And look, we all can look around us. Some people have really dark skin. Some people have kind of dark skin. Some people have medium and then light and then really light. That is epigenetic changes over time based on the environment, right? So we can see this through all kinds of different phenotypic changes in humans, but they're happening at other levels too that we don't recognize. So the epigenetic switches they happen in our life, they get expressed, they can get sort of encoded or ingrained and really, really conditioned into the biology to such a degree that they can be passed on, right? And if they're encoded again in that environment, and this is what makes the blue zones work so interesting that very few people like to talk about. But when you look at like Sardinia in the mountains, they have a genetic heritage that is actually really well preserved. And so what does that mean? That means that the people have basically lived there and not traveled out of there, and they haven't been conquered by many people. So that genetic heritage is conditioned for that environment. So now you have a bunch of people that have been doing the same things throughout many, many generations in the same area, passing down the same traditions that, and which ones get passed down? The ones that work, right? So now you have really, really culturally specific, environmentally specific behaviors, thoughts, beliefs, phenotypic changes that are conducive to health. And meanwhile, the ones that weren't conducive to health, particularly back in the day when they didn't have emergency care, they passed away. And there's a lot of younger people that passed away. So in order to create a blue zone, you probably needed a lot of people passing away at earlier ages that didn't carry through that phenotypic strength for that environment. Now what we're seeing is that those people are moving out, right? So the people in Sardinia, now they're going over to the mainland of Italy and they're traveling and they're going to university. And so we're now starting to intermix the genes, and they're losing their specificity for those environments, right? And so that's what becomes really interesting in this whole equation. And if I look at myself, I'm a European mutt living in San Diego, right? So I'm not exactly optimized for San Diego living, you know, in the traditional sense. And so we kind of have to just lose all that. We can't trace that whole thing. But that's what's interesting about the blue zones, is that, you know, people don't like to talk about it, but one of the things about the West is that we've saved a lot of, let's say, a lot of people who wouldn't have made it otherwise, right? That's the value of Western medicine. That's what's, we're keeping people alive. Even though they may not be in the best of health, it's worth saving as many people as we can, right? So that's the genius. Even though we may be passing on quote unquote weak genes or genes that have been, damaged to such a degree that have been put through the ringer, we can recover that, right? Like, we can actually rescue that by doing the right things, by doing healthy things. Look, we've had Agent Orange and we've had all kinds of chemical poisonings. You've dealt with that.
Agent Orange. My father was in Vietnam. Wow. And he got cancer from Agent Orange and passed away when I was 2 months old. And I know that that can be passed down from generation to generation and actually influence health too. I don't think the government has fully recognized the extent to which that it can actually influence health.
Yeah, I don't think they want to. I think they want to leave that door closed. Yeah. But this is the point, right? Like, all the damage that we've done with GMOs and all the things and the metals and the chemicals, we've destroyed our environment to such a degree that we've really done some damage to the human genome, so to speak. And I think we've created, I wouldn't say weaker, it's actually more sensitive. Just like the mouse that's been sensitized to lavender, we've been oversensitized to our environment, which means our nervous system's constantly on alert. And so there's a lot of work that we're doing now, I believe, in the sort of integrative health world, that everything that you're a part of, we're trying to recover some of this, and we can do that. So when we have kids and we do it the right way, and we improve their lifestyle, their environment, their diet, their mentality, all the things that are impacting their health, and then we bring on all this regenerative medicine capacity that we have, all of a sudden we can actually reverse those downward trends of sort of more chronic issues, right? And that's what we've seen. In fact, we've seen the predictive lifespan of humans decline in the West. Our children are supposed to die younger than we are, right? I mean, this is really weird, that if our children are living shorter lives than their parents, that's not how this has traditionally gone in the West. And that's what we've seen over the last 6, 7, 8 years, particularly over the last two, with all the social isolation, with all the drug epidemic that's happening. We're destroying the potential, but it can be recovered. And that's the beauty, is that we are so adaptive to our environment that all we've got to do is live from alignment, is get back into these sort of life-affirming qualities, and our genes will respond, our nervous system will respond, we will get back to a state of health and happiness, and that can be passed on as well.
Gosh, this has been interesting, informative, thought-provoking, I would say empowering too. There's so much that we can do to affect and influence these things. And I have one other question that maybe we can do very shortly and briefly before we talk about your book that's coming out, and then we wrap this up, is, I know we said right at the beginning, we were talking about all these places that you visited and these amazing people that you've seen living vibrant, active, healthy lives in their 70s, 80s, 90s. From a nutritional perspective and maybe some other things, what are the common things that you've seen there. If we could do just a little snippet of that, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, well, the most common thing was that they ate food that was conducive to their environment. So they operated seasonally. They grew foods when they can grow foods. None of them ate a lot of salads. Like, they didn't eat leaves, lettuce and kale and that kind of thing. They ate foods that were going to supply nutrition to them. And for them, because they were working outside all day, it was things like potatoes. It was things like sweet potatoes, root crops, anything that was going to provide actual nutrition. In other words, they kind of ate like a bodybuilder, right? They needed calories, right? Because they were working so hard. They literally worked their tails off. And so we talk about ketogenic diets, we talk about vegetarian and kind of a pescatarian, all these different strategies. Now we have things like the red meat diet, the carnivore diet, right? There's all these different strategies. And I would argue that these are ways that we are finding in the West to meet our needs based on the conditions that we're finding ourselves in. They didn't operate like that. They ate bread, they ate cheese, they ate meat in season, and it wasn't as nearly as much as we eat today. They ate a lot of corn, and they ate beans, lots of beans. That was a big one. The common things about their foods was it was high fiber. So they ate a lot of fruits and vegetables. Basically, they broke every rule that we have in the West, right? No sugar, no lectins, no wheat, no corn, no dairy, no soy, no meat, right? Some people say no fruit. Some people say no vegetables now, right? You have the meat plus fruit groups. Right. And they all have legitimate arguments for these things, right? Like, lectins in excess for some people that have high inflammation can be serious and not good. And yet you can cook foods in certain ways to lower the lectin load, right? They ate bread, but they ate different types of bread, and so everything was different, right? So this is what's interesting, is that I love studying those, because they basically dismantle any dogmatic view about nutrition that we have in the West. And I think for me, what I point to in the book when it comes to nutrition is I like to point back to the Ayurvedic teachings around nutrition. And there's ways to eat, and they're individualized based on your constitution, your genetics, and also your condition that you find yourself in. So if you find yourself in a health state that doesn't allow you to eat certain foods, then don't eat those foods until you've resolved the condition. But a lot of these foods that we're blaming as the problem, they're actually the gasoline, right? The house is on fire, and we're dumping gasoline on the house, and we're saying, well, it's the food, it's the gasoline's problem. No, the house is on fire. We got to put out the fire. And when we do, and we dump gasoline on the house, there's nothing, there's no problem. And then when I take that gasoline and I put it in my car, I got fuel, right? So gasoline isn't good, bad, or indifferent. It just depends on the situation that we're using it, right? And so that's what I think is important to say about diet. And again, it's when we eat, it's how much we eat, it's are we digesting our food? Because we can digest gluten. I don't care what anybody says. We have enzymes in our saliva that digest gluten. We have enzymes that we produce that digest gluten. We can break down. Gluten is just a protein. It's just a very long, hard protein to break down, but we can do it, right? And so certain people can do it really well, and other people don't do it very well. And there's reasons for that. Hydrochloric acid plays a huge role. Digestive enzymes play a role, right? Like, all this stuff plays a role. Your constitution plays a role. And then your health status plays a role. I'm not saying you should eat gluten or you shouldn't eat gluten. I'm just explaining why certain people seem to be able to eat it without as much issue as other people. And certain people can eat, you know, kale or lettuce without issue. And other people have tons of issues, right? Like, we can pick any food, and I've seen lots of people that are sensitive to all kinds of food, including things like, you know, celery and cucumber, right? So it's a sticky subject, but if we get the core things right and we break down some of the dogma, I think this is the important thing I want to say about it. Let go of the dogma of what you think you know. Instead, explore what your body's actually saying and listen to it. Trust it. Like, your body will communicate the right things to you. But in order to truly listen, we have to just hold some of these other things that other health experts are saying, and hold them lightly, right? And really not cling on to any truth, because that truth may shift. You may find that it's not a truth, but it's a partial truth.
And I love that you've just said, look, there's not a blanket approach for every single person. We're all biochemically and genetically unique individuals. We're going to respond to things differently. And I love that that's the approach that you take. Jason has a book called Beyond Longevity. I have a copy of it. He sent me a copy. It's an amazing book. You must read this book. You need to read it. It's amazing. I'll let Jason talk about it just a little bit here. Jason, could you just share, tell us about this amazing piece of work that you put together?
Yeah, well, we covered a little bit about it today, you know, but the first part of the book, I really discuss some of these bigger aspects of what aging is, what health is, what disease is, you know, where it comes from, and sort of the fundamentals and the foundational aspects to what it means to live a healthy life. And then the second, the probably two thirds of the book, the second part is really about how to achieve that, how to move that forward, right? So if you have chronic issues that you're dealing with, the idea is to move beyond those, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about. And the subtitle of the book is a proven plan for healing faster, feeling better, and thriving at any age. And that's what the book is about. And so the back half of the book, the two thirds of the book, is really designed to sort of walk you through that, right? We talk about sleep and circadian rhythm, right? Chronobiology, this idea that light is guiding your biology. You know, how to eat and what that looks like. We covered a little bit about it, but really ways to eat to thrive. We talk about digestion, but not only digestion, elimination, right? Like elimination is an aspect to health that most people don't talk enough about, but we need to be getting rid of things. We need to be removing waste product from the body, from the cell. So how do you remove waste from the cell in an effective and efficient way? This is a big part of what Ayurveda talks about, is how do we get rid of this metabolic waste? So that's a big part of moving things forward. Exercise, how do you exercise? Because that is going, depending on what your goals are and your objectives are, exercising looks different for each individual. In fact, in the blue zones, they don't even exercise. They just live. Right? This idea of leisure exercise was not a concept for them because they were moving all the time. We talk about processing stuck emotions. I read about that in the book, and how do we go about doing that, what that looks like, and why that's so important, right? And then things like mindfulness, how to practice mindfulness, how to infuse conscious changes, because stuck emotions are kind of subconscious things that we don't realize are there until we bring awareness to them and start working them. There's other things that we can actually bring conscious awareness to, right? Things like gratitude and looking for this sort of silver lining, seeing the positive. That's a practice, because we have a negativity bias that's built in, right? That's sort of sensing danger. So we can actually consciously practice this idea of finding the good, you know? And once we practice these things and they can start to become out, that can actually rewire your entire system. So there's ways, you know, based on this idea of neuroplasticity, growing new neural pathways, that we can consciously change these things. So that's a huge component. And then in the final chapter, I talk about rejuvenation. So what are some of the things? And I leave that for the last, because once we get all these other things right, then it's the proper time to really consider rejuvenation. But if we're trying to chase these rejuvenative therapies and biohacking, and we're not getting the foundations right, and we're missing all these opportunities, then we're just going to be chasing our tail, right? We're going to be trying to plug all the holes, and we're just not going to get there, right? It's whack-a-mole with our reality. And the point is that when we solve these other issues, these things that are out of alignment, it tends to be that everything else starts to resolve. And the beautiful thing about health is that as we resolve some of the health things, it leads to the other aspects of our life that we're looking for improvement around: relationships, finances, purpose, meaning, you know, business, all the things that make life worth living. They can start to improve because we're handling the core things that are preventing sort of the natural expression of our natural gifts, right? And I know you know this, Kevin. It's like once you step into that, it took me a long time to find it for myself, honestly. But once I did, I recognized it. And I said, that's the thing. That's what I need to pursue right there. And it becomes this pursuit that is sustainable, right? And it invigorates you and you thrive within that. And it in and of itself can become a medicine, right? So it's like you stop this downward spiral and you start, and everything starts working in your favor again. And the medicine becomes this driving force to evolution and progression and resolution and more medicine, right? And it just becomes this positive cycle. And I think to me, that's the gift. That's why it's so important to get out of this confined a chronic disease state that it can entrap us into a reality. And all we need to do is break free a little bit. And as we do, life opens up in magical, magical ways. And I look at your face and I can feel you. I know you know what I'm talking about. And it's like, I want that for everybody.
I love your passion. Like I'm excited for people to get this book, and I want to tell everybody where they can find this at too. So you want to let everybody know where they can find the book at also, and where they can find you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find it, of course, on Amazon and in most bookstores, you'll be able to find it. But you can also go to beyondlongevitybook.com, and there you will actually find some exclusive bonuses that I have that's actually going to take people from the book into action, and I'm going to help you do that. And so there really are exclusive bonuses for this book that I'm excited to share. So you can go to beyondlongevitybook.com and find those. And Kevin, thank you so much for having me on. It is a pleasure, and I am passionate. I'm passionate about sharing this because it is so meaningful. It's so meaningful.
Yeah, no, this is amazing. I'm going to leave the resources, all the links, everything in the show notes. You know, if you were listening to this and you found this helpful, make sure you hit the like button, share it with somebody you know that you think could benefit from this, because Jason dropped a lot of knowledge and some really amazing information in this episode. If you're on the podcast, be sure to subscribe. If you're on the YouTube, make sure you subscribe there as well. And you can find all of the resources, show notes, everything mentioned here today over at bonecoach.com/beyondlongevity. Jason Prawl. Jason, I want to thank you again so much for your time, and everybody for listening. We'll see you in the next episode. Hey, it's Bone Coach Kevin Ellis. Hope you found that episode helpful and that you enjoyed it. Just one last reminder, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com, sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart. It's going to tell you everything you need to do to start getting on the path to improvement. Hope you found this helpful. I'm your Bone Coach Kevin Ellis. I'll see you soon.